Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the former Maricopa County Sheriff Paul Penzone weighs in on the new Phoenix Police Chief.
And what's next for Phoenix's role as a hub for autonomous transportation technology?
But first, it's been more than a week since President Trump signed his so-called Big Beautiful Bill into law, ushering in major changes to, well, a whole lot, from the tax code to Medicaid, to food stamps, to the border, to the deficit, and more. There's even an overhaul of the nation's air traffic control system in there. But polling shows the bill is less than popular. One shows only 35% of adults supported it, and Republican lawmakers who voted for it are trying to figure out how to talk about it to voters to change that. Democrats have been hammering Medicaid cuts and tax cuts for the wealthy, and Republicans are talking about border funding and tax cuts for working families. And our next guest is here to tell us just how she thinks the big, beautiful budget might play here in Arizona. Gina Swoboda is chair of the Arizona Republican Party, and she's on the line now to talk more about it. Good morning, Gina. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with potential cuts to Medicaid, a popular program obviously making a lot of headlines right now. It insures nearly 2 million Arizonans. The bill doesn't directly cut Medicaid, but it adds work requirements, renewal requirements for people, which a lot of experts think it will mean, you know, a whole lot of people get kicked off, become uninsured, especially in rural areas of the state. Are you concerned about that?
So thank you for that. So the Medicaid eligibility requirements, like the provider Medicare taxes and the SNAP, they start in 2028. And one of my concerns, and I think the public's concerns based on how they voted in the last cycle, is that the states are expanding eligibility and have continued to do so based on federal funding. And the federal government, that was the point of DOGE, the country's going bankrupt. So at a certain point, and particularly let's talk about access, which for your listeners is the Arizona state version of Medicaid.
Yes.
I used to be on Access. I used to be on Medicare. You know, I was disabled for a while, and then I was uninsured and had a minor child. And it used to be if you had a child under a certain age and you were an adult, even if you weren't disabled, you were eligible, right? You don't want the parent of a child that's like beneath, you know, that line of eligibility to become ill.
Mm-hmm.
So we, and actually it was a Republican administration that did this in the state of Arizona. We expanded the Medicaid access eligibility to cover working adults with no minor children.
Yes.
And that are not disabled. And we just can't afford it. I mean, it would be wonderful, but we don't have fully socialized medicine in this country, and we can't afford it, obviously, because the country is, you know, teetering on a cliff. So if you need to try to cut spending somewhere, that's a place. The programs were created, you know, for vulnerable populations. It's really a question of, do you consider healthy working adults with no children to be a vulnerable population? And the hope is no. I take your point that in rural areas, particularly with regard to the renewal process, right?
Right.
So now let's say you are eligible and you're in this bucket and you don't renew. We had this extended period of time where people weren't having to recertify. The theory there is that you have people that are no longer eligible that are continuing on the program for years at a time, which again is draining the resources. And my concern, and I believe President Trump's concern and Congress, is that there are people that are vulnerable that truly need the benefits. And if we don't start to have people recertify and try to cut down on the massive, what I would call overexpansion, the program's going to collapse. Mm-hmm. And then the vulnerable population won't get anything.
Let me ask you about the spending involved in this, right? Because this is,
please,
you know, you're hearing lots of folks say this is tax cuts to the wealthy, cutting social safety net programs. It increases,
yeah,
the deficit by an estimated $3 trillion going forward.
Mm.
I mean, if you're talking about government spending, is that a concern?
I think that's a fair question. So when CBO scores, you know, they're looking at static models and they're scoring it as if the 2017 tax cuts went away. So that's, I'll put that to the side and let the economists argue about that. But the things that kick in immediately and that are retroactive are tax cuts for working people and, you know, people that are on Social Security, right? So the no tax on overtime. Our JLBC here in Arizona estimated that's 76.5 million that it will, quote, cost. Tax revenue we won't get anymore because we're no longer taxing that. But that $76.5 million that working people that are working overtime will have, which, you know, in theory, they're going to spend and put back into the economy.
Right.
On the no tax on tips, right? That's $23.5 million. For Social Security, all of us, I believe, agree we want our seniors to have more of the money. And when you think about it, Social Security, they've already paid a tax to put that money in there, and now they're drawing down that money. That's $53 million because all of the people that are over 65 are going to get a $6,000 tax deduction. So those go into effect retroactively to January. And what should happen is as these people are receiving these funds, they're getting more of their own money that they've earned or put into the system back. They're going to put that back into the economy.
Right. Okay. I want to talk about politics before I let you go. You ran a
Sure.
very successful campaign for Trump and his allies across the state in 2024. You gained Latino voters, rural voters, lots of talking about working class issues, right? Do you
Yeah.
think this kind of policy, where there are these massive tax cuts coming for wealthy people, especially, is that going to make that message harder to sell in 2026 here in Arizona?
Well, you know, for my part, as we just discussed, I am the thing I was most concerned about is the existing tax cuts going away, because that the result of that is actually a tax hike. And I do think in states like New York and like California, the SALT tax, and for the listeners, and your listeners are very high acuity on economic issues, so I know they know what I'm talking about. But the SALT tax is where state taxes are offset by a federal tax cut. That was a big bone of contention, right? Particularly in the House. And we let that go through. I think they wound up at like $40,000. So there are states with people making a lot of money that their states have chosen to have very high taxes that federal taxpayers in states like Arizona are now carrying them. So the idea that we're going to let working people continue to be taxed and not give them a new break on money they've earned, or like with Social Security, money they've already contributed into the system, so that New York and California can give a $40,000 tax credit to people who truly are the wealthy, is a non-starter. Our
Okay.
working people and our vulnerable seniors need to have more money in their pocket. I think that if we discuss it like that, Lauren, then I think people will get it.
All right, we'll have to leave it there for now. Lots more to talk about in the future. Gina Swoboda, chair of the Arizona Republican Party, joining us. Gina, thank you.
Thank you.
State agencies have more Senate-confirmed directors now than they did earlier this year. That's after the chamber voted to confirm 12 directors this year, including those for the Departments of Economic Security, Administration, Homeland Security, and Child Safety, among eight others. That means those nominees advance through the Senate Committee on Director Nominations, or DINO Committee, before facing the full Senate. That committee process has been a point of contention between the Senate and Governor Hobbs since the committee was formed after she won election in 2022. It led to a lawsuit when the governor tried to get around the committee to appoint people to lead these agencies. A court ruled that move was illegal. With me now to talk about what's changed is the committee's vice chair, Senator T.J. Shoup, a Republican from Coolidge. Senator, good morning.
Good morning to you, and good morning to everybody listening.
So, what changed?
Well, I think that there was a period of time, obviously, after the lawsuit where it seemed that, well, leading up to the lawsuit, obviously, there was definitely a standoff, if you will, that obviously the Senate decided to file suit in order to prevent the governor from just naming every director a deputy director to essentially have the same position and have no direct report. But I think cooler heads prevailed after the suit was won by the Senate, if you will, and we decided to go down the path. That doesn't mean that there weren't any slight skirmishes along the way, including, I think, at one point the governor saying after, I believe it was the Department of Insurance and Financial Institutions potential director, Barbara Richardson, when we rejected her, that she would no longer send any nominees to the Dino committee. And if you follow me on social media, you'll know that before we start, I always have my favorite Dino from the Flintstones that I tweet out just to tell you what the mood of the day is. But we did subsequently come back and have hearings on others like the Department of Agriculture, which is one of the most expansive agencies in state government that people are not aware of. Even if you don't farm, odds are you probably go to a grocery store or fill up your tank with gas, which is regulated by the Department of Agriculture, mm-hmm. for example, along with some of the other entities like military affairs, the emergency management, things like that. So which obviously some of those are just, in essence, almost pass-throughs of federal dollars that come into the state of Arizona in the event of a disaster, for example, or other things that like homeland security issues and such. So it's it kind of ran the gamut, and we closed up the session confirming a couple more nominees. And I think that the batting average was actually pretty good. And frankly, I think that we have some good people. When there was availability for agreement between a very right-of-center Senate and a left-of-center governor, we came up with the best nominees to lead these agencies.
Was there conversation between Governor Hobbs or her staff or office and Republican members of this committee to see, okay, I'd like to put this person up. Is that somebody that you can accept, or did she just kind of take her chances and you guys were more okay with the people that she sent this time?
I think that if you talk about year one, there was a lot of let's roll the dice with the people that we want to lead. We got elected. We have a mandate, albeit the mandate was obviously very small. It was a very tightly contested election. And admittedly, on my end, I would say at the time, ours was, we had just picked up a seat.
Right?
We had just, we were coming into it with that one-seat majority. And we had, I would argue, an equally small mandate. We were able, when we expanded the majority by that seat, it kind of put us in a stronger position to say, look, I think that we have to have an equal footing here. We have the advise and consent portion of the Constitution of the state that we have to respect. Let's work together to make sure that the people that you're placing in front of this committee they're going to go through a vetting process. That is most definitely going to happen. But let's make sure that it's somebody that has a chance to make it through. I have to say the people that put themselves into the hot seat, and I always mention this during the committee hearings, kudos to them because they know that they are going to be grilled. But the reality is I don't foresee a future state Senate going back to the old rubber stamp. And this is whether it's a Republican administration or a Democratic administration. These are multi-billion dollar agencies. If you were going to try to take over a business and you had to go in front of a board of directors, you were trying to be the CEO, my odds are they would have a book about you prior to leading an agency such as the Department of Corrections, for example, which is a multiples of billions of dollars. We're going to go ahead and do the proper vetting that is befitting of the taxpayers' dollars.
One of the criticisms that this committee got, and I know you heard it, is that some of the questions were maybe a little off topic, I guess, or talking about a director's personal views on something that agency didn't have really anything to do with. Did you see less of that as nominees started getting approved by your committee and ultimately the Senate?
I think that you definitely saw more of a look. It was a learning experience for both sides here. I think the governor had a learning experience on what was going to be what the politics of the possible were getting through that committee and through the entire Senate. And I think the committee had a learning experience as well, because we had not tried a committee like that mm-hmm. before in the state Senate. So it was brand new. And I think we were both feeling out how this was supposed to operate. I will say that as time went on, it most definitely, in my opinion anyway, seemed more professionalized with each meeting that we had. And I believe that we felt that in the end we had better prepared nominees to go to the full Senate. Remember, as we go through this, that committee, its task is to recommend a yes or no vote for the rest of our colleagues in the entire state Senate. So we have that discussion. We bring out all the information that we possibly can so that people have a comfort level with a vote that they are going to take, affirmative or negative, on the floor. And the preparation that goes into it is tremendous, because we want people to feel comfortable with what they're voting on, just like we would on any other bill that's being heard in the state Senate.
Sure. All right. We'll have to leave it there. State Senator T.J. Shope, a Republican from Coolidge. Senator, thanks. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, baseball has long been connected to social change and racial integration. So why do we see so few Black Major League Baseball players?
But first, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays has joined more than 20 other states in a lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's freezing of nearly $7 billion in education funding. Arizona's share of that is more than $100 million and comes as students are set to return to the classroom as early as this week in some districts. With me to talk about this and the impact this funding freeze could have on Arizona schools is Beth Lewis, director of Save Our Schools Arizona and a former educator. And Beth, what are you hearing from folks in public education about the fact that this money has been frozen?
Yeah, I mean, it's, as you can imagine, school districts across Arizona have been thrown into total chaos. Arizona schools go back earlier than the rest of the country. My kids go back tomorrow in Chandler. And so a lot of school leaders are figuring out what programs to put on hold in the wake of all of this, right? This is $120 million for students who are English language learners, for before and after school care. I mean, we're talking tons of kids across our state that are going to be impacted. And some districts are big enough to sort of absorb these blows while people in DC figure it out, and some school districts are not. And so I think that the impacts are going to be really felt immediately, and also, you know, it'll have a devastating impact on our districts and our kids.
For those districts that are not big enough to be able to sort of withstand this kind of reduction in funding, even if it's temporary, what are they going to be doing? What gets cut?
So, you know, before and after school care is a huge piece of what our local schools do for families, working families, and something that, you know, we know the families rely on heavily. I'm really worried that schools, you know, especially in rural areas, smaller schools are, you know, families are going to show up the first day of school expecting that before and after school care, and it may not be available until these lawsuits are settled or until there's enough pressure on Congress to pressure President Trump to release these funds. And again, these are congressionally approved funds. This is not held up in some budget negotiation, right? These were approved last year and were supposed to be released on July 1st.
Well, so you mentioned before and after school care. What kinds of other programs might this affect, even for some of those larger districts that can absorb some of the cuts? I mean, the money has to come from somewhere.
Yeah. Well, another huge piece of this is instruction for students that are learning English. And obviously that, you know, is a huge portion of our students across Arizona. We know that Tucson is at risk of losing nearly 8 million. Mesa School District is at risk of losing over 4 million. Those are two of our largest school districts in the state. So obviously that number is higher. But that becomes, you know, an unfunded mandate, right? Schools are legally obligated to serve English learners and to make sure that they're getting all of the services that they need to be successful in school. And yet, if there's no funding for that instruction, it's going to have to come from elsewhere. And we know Arizona schools are chronically underfunded. We know that the state doesn't give enough. And so there's already enough sweeping from all of these different buckets, just trying to basically put Band-Aids on these gaping wounds that our legislatures left us with, and now we've got the feds coming in and injecting chaos into this. And, you know, it's really disappointing to see our nation's leaders acting like this with such utter disregard for children and for families. And it, you know, at this point, it really feels like the cruelty is the point.
So you mentioned the timing and how, you know, your kids are going back to school tomorrow. A lot of districts are starting either later this month or the very beginning of August. What does that do at the beginning of the school year and at the pretty early on in the state's fiscal year? Like, what does that do for budgets going forward to have to maybe scramble a little bit so early on?
Again, I think it's chaos, and feels like chaos is also the point. You know, our school districts are scrambling; they're pulling together last minute board meetings, right? And I think there's less opportunity for the public to get involved because it's the middle of the summer, and just scrambling internally to say, okay, what can we do without right now? And these are desperately needed programs, right? It's not like there's any like fat to trim in Arizona's public schools. So you know, I think that Arizona families are probably going to feel this, and it could come off in weird ways, right? Like it might be, well, we don't have a football coach this quarter, and parents might be really upset, but you might not be able to pay a football coach's stipend if it's choosing between that and before and after school care, right? Or you might have an after school drama program that your fifth graders really, really love, and we don't get to do that until December because that money is spoken for. And so, again, when you're on these shoestring budgets, when you're already operating in a starving space, you know, these cuts are going to be felt really keenly by families.
So you mentioned lawsuits. Attorney General Chris Mays joined a number of other states yesterday in a lawsuit challenging these cuts. The wheels of justice, though, you know, don't move super quickly necessarily. So I'm wondering, you know, even if these attorneys general are successful, presumably it will take some amount of time to get that kind of decision, and then there are appeals and everything. So is that the answer for schools to go the legal route?
I think it has to be the answer. I'm so grateful for Attorney General Mays for joining the lawsuit. I ultimately think it will be successful because, quite frankly, it is utterly unlawful for a president to unilaterally withhold congressionally approved funding for kids. There really isn't any way of escaping that. And I think that, again, there's cruelty, there's chaos at the heart of this, but it's also a test balloon. We know that the Trump administration has already signaled that it's trying to dismantle public education. So, you know, is this a test balloon for stripping away Title I funds? Is this a test balloon for stripping away IDEA funds for students with special needs? Absolutely. I think all scholars who are following this carefully understand exactly what this is. It's not just some funding for some small programs. This is massive funding for massive programs that are really important for kids. And it's just the beginning of what is, you know, hopefully going to be stopped in its tracks by the court. But we know, you know, the Trump administration is obviously acting in a lot of ways to destroy public schools. They just this week, the Supreme Court ruled that the Trump administration could go forward with a plan to strip half of the positions at the Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education. And those are all the folks that are in charge of making sure that the laws are met and that students' civil rights are met. And, you know, if you had funding for students with who were learning the English language, and then you strip that funding and there's nobody in charge in DC making sure that those laws are followed, you've got complete chaos and you've got kids that are not going to get what they need.
All right. That is Beth Lewis, director of Save Our Schools Arizona. Beth, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Yeah. Thanks, Mark.
After an exhaustive search and a scathing Department of Justice report, the Phoenix Police Department has a new chief, Matt Giordano. Giordano currently heads up the Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, or AZ Post, but he started his career at the Phoenix Police Department and retired as a commander. He then went on to serve as Executive Chief of Enforcement at the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, where he served under our next guest, former Sheriff Paul Penzone. Giordano takes the helm at Phoenix PD after a year of turmoil within the department. Last year, the Department of Justice released a report finding a pattern of civil rights abuses and discrimination by Phoenix police officers. But under the Trump administration, the DOJ rescinded its findings and closed its investigation with no accountability measures forced upon the department. City leaders say they are committed to reform regardless. It's a situation that Penzone can relate to. He took over the sheriff's office after the long and controversial reign of Joe Arpaio. But that department was and still is under a court order because of civil rights violations there. He told me he thinks Giordano is in a good position to move the department forward.
It's a unique time for the Phoenix Police Department to kind of redefine themselves. You know, every agency goes through challenges, ups and downs, and I reflect back on my career there and was very proud of that time and that era. And I think that in the current landscape, things have become a little bit, challenges have evolved.
Yeah.
But in order for them to move forward in a healthy way, I do think it was wise to go with someone who's very familiar not only with the agency, but with the community.
So Giordano, I know, worked for you for some time when you were sheriff of the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. Tell us, you know, about his experience. What experience do you think he can bring to the job based on his time with you? And as you mentioned, his long time in local law enforcement.
Sure. And I had familiarity with Matt prior to that. We didn't work directly together while I was at Phoenix PD, but we definitely knew each other. And he came over to the sheriff's office to oversee all of the enforcement operations. So it was a big lift, high responsibility position, especially when, you know, in my case, a new sheriff, when I hadn't seen one in a quarter of a century. And then you bring in some folks who you believe are best suited to do two things. One is to ensure that those operations are fluid and efficient and effective and ethical. But also, yeah, you have to have the personality to mesh, you know, to where you can get along with people, because those in the agency sometimes can feel threatened when you bring, you know, what they would deem an outsider in. And Matt has that disposition that he gets along with people really well. He, you know, he has a very, if you look at his resume and his experience, it's broad, it's deep, it's vast. So he was a good fit for us. So his role there was, it was big. It, you know, had a lot of lift to it, and it had its challenges. And most of the time, we agreed on things. Sometimes we didn't disagree, but it was always a very collegial interaction.
So as you're kind of referencing there, he is going into a department that, you know, has faced some controversy of late. It recently got hit with a scathing Department of Justice report, findings of discrimination, excessive use of force, lack of accountability, lots of issues. You have been in a similar position where you've taken over a law enforcement agency here that was kind of mired in controversy as you took over MCSO following Joe Arpaio. What kind of challenges is he facing going into that kind of situation?
Well, there are similarities, but there's also some differences. And I'll speak to those first, and then I'll get into the details. But, you know, for Matt, the benefit is he is familiar with the agency. You know, that's where he spent most of his time before going to the sheriff's office. So it's kind of like going home. You know, you have relationships, you have a standing, and you're not really starting from scratch. Whereas when I took over the sheriff's office, I was a stranger in a strange land. So not only did I have the dynamics of federal court oversight and the challenges, but I had to give the organization opportunity to learn about and get to know me, and vice versa.
Yeah.
So I think for Matt, what's going to be really challenging is, contrary to what I just spoke of, when you don't have those relationships, you don't get as, you know, you try to avoid subjectivity. You try to avoid emotion. You try to keep relationships out of your decisions, because ultimately when you're the head of the office, you're the gatekeeper. So as you look at the issues of concern that the Phoenix Police Department has faced, first, you have to separate fact from fiction. Some of the things that the Department of Justice alleged may have been very accurate and justified allegations. Others, maybe not so much. Now, you're going to be embedded in there 24/7 with the men and women, and you owe it to them to do a fair and thoughtful assessment, not only of what occurred at that time, but where they are now. Because let's not forget, they had an interim chief who made a lot of changes, made a lot of, you know, took a lot of steps to negate maybe the problems that they had, to improve on certain things. So they're not the same agency today that they were a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. So you have to do a fair assessment, and you have to ask yourself, are you willing to do what's difficult to ensure that in a year, 2 years from now going forward, this community looks at that agency and sees it through a lens where they have nothing less than pride and gratitude for the sacrifices of those in uniform that are doing the job, because they're doing it the right way to the highest standard.
So let me ask you a forward-looking question then. The DOJ report was essentially pulled by the Trump administration. There will be no consent decree, no court oversight, no federal government oversight here. City leaders, as you said, have promised continued action. We saw some of that from the interim chief. They're promising accountability and change. Do you think choosing someone as chief with Giordano's background will kind of help the city move in that direction?
You know, I'll speak as a citizen. I hope so. You know, and it's interesting, because coming into this interview, I thought a lot about it. And I remember, again, I'll reflect on my own experiences. When I was elected sheriff, and there were critics, you know, is this guy qualified? Does he have the experience? How can he, you know, do what we need to do? There are others who believe strongly in me. But I look at it through this lens. It's so hard to prognosticate how someone will do when they hold the ultimate authority and responsibility in an agency. Now, with that being said, I'd like to think that Matt has those attributes. You check those boxes, and you would expect that he is experienced and primed for success, which means it's in the best interest of the community and the agency. Because we always have to think about the men and women who are sacrificing and ensure that they're at the front of our thoughts also as we prepare for this. But I don't think anyone truly understands the weight, I'll say, of the office, because I held the office, but of that responsibility until suddenly you put those stars on your collar, and you are the person whose name is on the front page. You're the one who is facing any and all criticism, and you're the one who has to stand in front of audiences who oppose your position for their own, beliefs, and you have to stand your ground and do what you know to be true to the authority of the office.
Let me ask you, Giordano has spent the last several years at AZ Post, which creates the standards and training for officers across the state, but they're also the organization that deals with disciplinary actions against officers. How might that kind of play into his role? Like, I imagine it's a tough balance to strike, like earning officers' trust and maintaining the public trust when it comes to accountability when officers, go wrong.
It will reveal you. And I'm not speaking solely of Matt. The same applied to me and anyone who's been in that position. I think the benefit is AZ Post is so heavily rooted in training as well as the oversight that it really puts you in a position to understand the needs to develop, to educate, and to prepare those who are, putting the badge and the gun on. So I think there's an inherent benefit to that. But at the end of the day, more often than not, you are addressing failures. Your job at the head is to say, where did we make a mistake or a failure, and how do we correct it? And it might be training. It might be some form of low-end discipline. It could be a suspension. It could be a separation. You have to make those decisions absent of any relational element. And you have to treat everyone equally. And you have to make hard decisions that kind of fall in this space that if you're taking someone's livelihood and it was a lifetime passion for them, better make sure it's the right decision to the best of your ability. And if you steer into a direction where you think because you know them personally and that really wasn't, that's not their characteristic and they made a mistake, all those things are nice on the heart, but everyone looks on to you to treat each member of the organization with fairness, objectivity, and consistency. No one should be above the rules and no one should be outside the law. So you have to put yourself on an island, and that's not easy to do. But if you want to be in charge of an organization, you shouldn't worry about being liked, although you should be likable. You shouldn't worry about being respected, although you should always lead with respect. You should just worry about that you make your decisions in that moment with all the information you have available to the best interest of the people you serve and those who have empowered you to serve on their behalf.
All right. Former Maricopa County Sheriff Paul Penzone joining us. Paul, thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate you taking the time.
No, it's been an honor. Thank you, Lauren. Have a great day.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Tesla has applied to the State Transportation Department to be allowed to start testing its autonomous vehicles around the valley. A decision from ADOT could come by the end of the month. Waymo has been operating here for several years and covers more than 300 square miles of the Phoenix metro area. At the same time, Honeywell recently announced it had tested an autonomous helicopter in Phoenix. Other companies are also reportedly working on similar projects. So with all that, what is the future of autonomous transportation in and around the valley? And what makes the region so popular for this kind of technology? With me now to talk about this is Andrew Hawkins, transportation editor at The Verge. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning.
So is it surprising in any way that Tesla is looking to test out its AVs in Phoenix, given Waymo and everything else going on around here?
Yeah, I don't think it is. I think it's actually a pretty smart move from the company. I think they recognize that Phoenix has grown to become a staging ground for autonomous testing. Obviously, Waymo has been there for a number of years, and I think that Tesla is very eager to want its vehicles to be sort of viewed side by side with Waymo's vehicles from a customer standpoint. So I think it makes sense that they're going to try to get a toehold in the city so that they can eventually get there.
Does it make sense to try to compete with Waymo in a place like Phoenix as opposed to maybe going to a place where there aren't already autonomous, sort of robo taxis?
That's a really great question. I think that a lot of experts in this field see Waymo's lead as pretty commanding at this point, that Tesla has a lot of catching up to do if it wants to inevitably compete toe-to-toe with Waymo. But that said, if it wants to eventually get there, and Elon Musk has said that he wants, you know, hundreds of autonomous vehicles, robo-taxis within a few months, potentially a million on the road by the end of next year, which seems a little outlandish at this point, but, you know, that's that is Musk's way of talking about these things. So I think it does make sense to want to come into the Arizona market, because I think that what you're dealing with is a couple of things. You have a regulatory system that is very favorable to technology companies who do want to test their vehicles there. There are not as many onerous requirements as there are in states like California. And also there's a very favorable just geographic environment. It's, mm-hmm. it's flat. It's weather is very consistent. The city is laid out. Phoenix is laid out in a grid pattern, which is very favorable for autonomous vehicles. So I think that there's a number of elements that make Arizona an attractive place for Tesla to want to test its vehicles.
Well, I suppose there's also the aspect of, at least to some degree, people in the Phoenix area are kind of used to this kind of technology, and maybe Tesla isn't starting from scratch to try to convince people that the concept of AVs is scary and maybe one that they should embrace.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely correct. I think that what you're dealing with is a number of, you know, customers that are familiar with the technology, they're comfortable with it, perhaps they're even more trusting of it than maybe people who live in other cities. And I think that, as we've seen, you know, it hasn't been a completely, you know, obstacle-free rollout for Waymo, right? That mm-hmm. Waymo has run into problems in California. There were protests against ICE in Los Angeles recently, where a number of Waymo vehicles were destroyed. And that was probably because of, you know, some tension between LA residents and Waymo, that they see the companies as being sort of at the vanguard of surveillance and other things like that, and collaborating with police departments. So I think that sort of political situation maybe doesn't exist quite as much as it does in Arizona as it does in California. So I think that that's another thing. But yeah, I agree that residents of Phoenix, they're more comfortable with it. They trust the technology, and really autonomous vehicles and robo taxis, it really does all come down to trust, because you are getting into a vehicle with no one in the front seat, and you really need to trust that company and its technology in order to trust, you know, to put your life in their hands.
Yeah. So, Andrew, let me ask you about this autonomous helicopter that Honeywell tested out. There are other, as I mentioned, other companies also working on this kind of technology. Where are we in terms of having this kind of thing ready to go, and how different might they be from, say, drones?
Yeah, it's a real fastly moving field of technology right now. You have sort of a lot of companies operating in this space that's called electric vertical takeoff and landing, or eVTOL. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's, you know, Honeywell, in addition to Joby and Lilium and Archer, and a number of other companies have been testing their aircraft in a number of markets. Nothing has reached the stage of commercial viability yet. There's a number of certification requirements at the FAA level that they still need to receive in order to get their technology approved to carry passengers, for example. Lots of obstacles sort of remaining there. But yeah, I do think that it is a space where a lot of investors in tech are focused on. They see, you know, sort of the promise of, you know, of flying cars as sort of being something that has some connections to this technology. And I think that it makes sense that those vehicles would be autonomous, that you would be able to remove the pilot from some of these vehicles at a certain point in the future. So it is a company where there's a lot of money being poured into, a lot of fast moving developments, but still sort of a lot of challenges remaining on the regulatory side as well.
Sure. All right. That is Andrew Hawkins, transportation editor at The Verge. Andrew, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. We're just a little past the halfway point of the MLB season. The annual All-Star Game is coming up tonight in Atlanta. Opening day rosters across baseball this year featured more than 250 international players representing 18 different countries. But my next guest argues there's at least one demographic that's not represented in MLB as much as it could and should be. Gerald Early is a professor of African and African American Studies at Washington University in St. Louis and author of the book Play Harder, The Triumph of Black Baseball in America, which came out earlier this season. He says African Americans have been playing baseball for a lot longer than many people realize. And when I spoke with him earlier, I asked what attracted African Americans to baseball more than a century ago.
Well, I think in the 19th century, around the time of the Civil War, I think Black people were attracted to baseball because it was a growing sport in the United States. It was a popular sport in the United States. I think partly Black people wanted to play it because they felt it would make them seem more American. You must remember at this time, right after the Civil War, Black people's citizenship in the United States was not settled until the passage of the 14th Amendment. Mm-hmm. And so playing baseball was a way of showing themselves as being American. I also think it was attractive because it showed Black people could organize and do things for themselves. And organizing was very important for Black people for the uplift of the race.
It's interesting because I think for a lot of Americans, they look at baseball, and even if they don't necessarily consider it any more the national pastime, for a lot of folks, baseball is sort of seen as the sport that maybe reflects America or is thought of as quintessentially American more so than other sports. It's interesting that, you know, around the time of the Civil War, that was also seemingly the way that African Americans were thinking about it, too.
Yes, I believe so. Baseball is our oldest professional sport. And in this way, it has kind of some deeper roots than other sports. And I think it has a certain kind of tradition that Americans especially feel close to. Baseball is represents a real sense of what America is about.
Let me ask you about the 1940s when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier when he came up, of course, with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And I was reading some interesting commentary this year around Jackie Robinson Day, which is celebrated every year across Major League Baseball. And there were some writers suggesting that the true story of Jackie Robinson making it to the majors is not really told, in the sense that, yes, he was able to play and made the majors and broke the color barrier, but A, it was not that easy for him, and he endured horrible things both before and after. And also, it wasn't like that led to a flood of Black players making it to the majors as well. I'm wondering what you make of that kind of criticism of the way that we celebrate Jackie Robinson and Jackie Robinson Day, and maybe think about how the color barrier in baseball was broken.
Well, Robinson, it wasn't easy for Robinson to do it. He had to endure a great deal. That's all true. And it didn't lead to a flood of Black players. At least it didn't lead to a flood of Black players on other teams. Integration was slow in Major League Baseball. Robinson, I think, prevailed largely because of his personality.
Why do you think it is that with Robinson's success when he made the majors and the Dodgers' success with him on the team, why didn't more teams bring Black players aboard?
Well, you know, it's institutional structural racism, the racism of the old boy network in baseball. It was some owners believe, oh, you know, some owners believe that old Hollywood studios believe, oh, you know, sound movies, that's just a passing fancy. That's not really going to last. And, you know, Black people in baseball, that's a fad. That's not really going to last. Some people were afraid, some owners were afraid that it was going to alienate white people from going to ball games. They didn't want to do that, alienate white fans. So there were several reasons why owners were very slow about doing it. And they didn't feel as though they really needed Black players. As time went along and Black players had enormous success, outside success in the major leagues, integration began to pick up a little more and a little more. But also there were changes in the country that were happening that also propelled integration.
To what do you attribute the fact that even as, you know, it took so long for Jackie Robinson to break the color barrier, and as you've discussed, you know, a lot of teams didn't bring in a lot of other African-American players in the immediate seasons following, and yet it seems as though that didn't really cause a drop in interest among African-Americans to play baseball. I'm curious to what you attribute that.
Baseball was still the major sport in the United States. Robinson making it, in fact, made a lot of black people, black players, black athletes think, oh, yeah, well, if he made it, I can make it too. So, no, there wasn't an immediate drop off in interest of blacks wanting to play baseball. And the other thing is that even though some of the Negro Leagues died after Robinson made it in 1947, Negro League baseball still continued for at least another 10 years. So there were still players still playing in the Negro Leagues.
So, what do you think then led to the drop-off in participation in baseball among Black Americans? Because, you know, we see, for example, right now, Major League Baseball over the last few years has really been trying to make an effort to get more players from the African American community into baseball. What led to the decline in the first place, do you think?
Oh, I think it was several factors led to the decline, and among them is that the rise of black athletes having access to professional football and professional basketball as these sports began to really rise in America and become powerful presence in American professional sports, and also the collegiate element of both of those sports as well. And those sports also became basketball and football much more embedded in Black American school culture, both at Black colleges and also in Black high school culture. And baseball, on the other hand, did not become nearly as embedded in Black people's school culture as those other sports did. So that's partly it. The other thing is that Black people, as fans of the sport, seem to have dropped off, and their interest in the game seemed to have dropped off as they drifted more toward basketball and football, especially as the number of Black people in those sports increased. The thing is that baseball, in some ways, may not feel terrific pressure about diversifying because so many Black Latinos play the game. There's not a lot lack of Black people playing Major League Baseball, playing professional baseball. It's just a lack of Black Americans playing it.
How important is it to have stars of the game, black stars of the game, really make this a priority? I'm thinking of people like CeCe Sabathia or Mookie Betts, people who are, you know, not shy about speaking their mind and saying what's important to them. Like, are folks like that, are players like that, are former players like that really able to make a difference here?
Anything helps. And if those players speak out and really make this a priority and really go to the black community and preach the gospel of baseball, I mean, really go to black schools and preach the gospel of baseball and tell those kids this is a great game. You know, it's a deep part of black people's heritage. We used to have leagues, we organized teams, stuff like that. It is a deep part of your history. If people started preaching that a lot, yeah, I think it would have an effect. I'm not saying that by itself it would make a drastic change, but it would certainly be the start of something. Black people need to be reminded of how much baseball is embedded in their cultural heritage. It's like jazz. It's like ragtime. It's deeply embedded in Black people's heritage.
Gerald Early is a professor of African and African American Studies at Washington University and author of the book Play Harder: The Triumph of Black Baseball in America.
All right, that'll do it for today's edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow with much more. Thanks for joining us. And you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It's called Radio Heads, and it's at theshow.kjzz.org.
You can also follow us on Instagram. Lauren, you're on Instagram, right? I am not. But
I am.
Okay.
But I'm not very good at it.
Okay. Well, you know who is good at it? The people who curate at KJZZ The Show.
Yes,
I don't
they
know
are.
Exactly who that is, but they do a great job. I've been told it's a wonderful follow. So
you can find all the things we talk about there.
All
it's
the
amazing.
Things we talk. You can find all the things there at KJZZ The Show on Instagram. All right. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.